nothing about the Trump-Kim agenda deserves our applause, and young Kim doesn't deserve our vote.
Gil Cisneros deceived us just to get elected, because Gil Cisneros puts his interests over ours.
That's right. Steele didn't go after the corruption. She went after the agency that was trying to clean it up.
Tell tax cheat, tax-raising hypocrite Harley Ruda, it's game over.
Just a sampling of ads from two hotly contested California congressional races. The race in the 39th district between Gil Cisneros and Young Kim, and Harley Ruda and Michelle Steele in the 48th, both in Orange County. Republicans think they have a chance of unseating Ruda and Cisneros, reversing at least a small part of the blue wave of 2 years ago, where Orange County turned completely blue. That was historic for a region that has produced two Republican presidents, Nixon and Reagan. We're going to talk about all this now with Paul Mitchell, vice president of Political Data, Inc. That's a bipartisan voter data firm. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. Also, Dan Schnurr, former Republican political strategist, now a professor at USC, UC Berkeley, and Pepperdine, and the no party preference voter. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, Paul, let's look at the data that you have collected in terms of who has voted so far. What does it look like?
Well, it's actually really extraordinary. We're seeing the most rapid rate of returns of early ballots that we've ever seen in the state's history. To put it in perspective, we've already had more people return their ballots in this election than did in the entirety of 2018 in these districts.
Well, we are in the middle of a pandemic, so is it really that surprising that people are returning their ballots by mail?
Well, we are mailing everybody ballots, but remember, in Orange County, they actually didn't change their system. In Orange County, they mailed everybody a ballot in the primary. So this is the second election that we're seeing this. So we already were a state that had a lot of vote by mail. It's just that we've never seen it come this early. So a real rapid first wave of ballots. It actually also, we've been seeing in the data that Democrats are turning in their ballots quicker, and Republicans, a lot of Republicans are saying they're going to still vote in person on Election Day.
Mm. Well, also, there is generally more enthusiasm for a general election than for a primary or an election that it doesn't involve the president of the United States, a president that is certainly animating both sides to get excited about voting.
Well, absolutely. And this election has definitely brought that out. We're expecting definitely record turnout across the state. In terms of raw voters, we have 22 million voters right now. And that's a number that's been growing considerably in the last several election cycles. And the enthusiasm we're seeing this election really points to record numbers of voters, probably a raw voter total that we've never seen before, and percentages that reach as high as it was maybe in 2008 or before that in the 1980 election.
Oh, wow. All right, Dan, let's look at these two races in Orange County. First, Gil Cisneros versus Young Kim. This seems to be a repeat from the race from 2 years ago, but what's different this time around?
Well, I think the biggest difference this time in the eyes of Young Kim's campaign, it's that Cisneros is an incumbent running for re-election as opposed to someone running for the seat for the first time. Now, certainly being an incumbent has all sorts of institutional advantages, but it allows Kim to run a campaign against Cisneros' voting record in a way that she wasn't able to 2 years ago. I mean, Madeline, make no mistake about it. Both of these districts are still Republican districts. But these are Romney Republicans. These are Bush Republicans. These are pre-Trump Republicans. And in both 2016, when they voted for Hillary Clinton in the presidential election, and in 2018 midterms, when they were voting to send a very strong message at Donald Trump, a lot of those pre-Trump, more traditional conservative Republicans simply didn't vote. The challenge for both Republican challengers this year, both Young Kim and Michelle Steele, is to somehow convince those Republicans who don't like Donald Trump that they're not Donald Trump, and to convince those Republicans who do like Donald Trump that they are Donald Trump. So how hard can that be?
How are they doing that then? How are they threading that extremely small needle?
Well, both of them are walking a very fine line on this, as you see with Republican congressional candidates in suburban districts all over the country. So they're looking for ways to ally themselves on issues on which he does enjoy more support, particularly from Republican voters, like economic issues, on issues like the pandemic and on others as well, they look for ways to distance themselves from him, but not too far, because they'll still have to figure out a way to turn out their base.
Right. So speaking of the pandemic, that seems to be the animating issue in the other race, Democrat Harley Ruta against Republican Michelle Steele. She is on the Orange County Board of Supervisors and made some really controversial remarks early on about masks and how basically you wouldn't put a mask on a dog, so why put a mask on a person, and saying that it's unhealthy to wear masks. Is that turning out to be the animating issue for that district?
It appears that it is. I mean, more broadly across the state, I think you can safely say that anyone who has strongly resisted, almost anyone who has strongly resisted wearing a mask, is probably a pretty Trump-safe voter. But in more conservative-leaning communities, Steele believes this is a way to get some of those non-Trump Republicans to support her. I suspect if she is successful on Election Day, and I'd say the same thing about Young Kim, it's less on the way that their party or their party base or they themselves have approached the pandemic, but more that Republicans, after many, many years of succeeding in a very white Orange County, have been running very white candidates. In both of these races, they're running Asian American women, which reflects the changing demographics of both districts. If it ends up being a campaign about the pandemic, I don't know that that's a good thing for either Steele or for Kim. But if they can tap into those growing Asian Pacific communities in Orange County, that's probably their best bet at this point.
And so far, Paul, I don't know if you've drilled down into the specifics of both of these districts and these races, but are they both very close?
These are districts that were considered pretty safe Republican, that voted for Republican candidates in 2016 when Hillary Clinton won Orange County. The fact that these races were won by Democrats in 2018 was what I think everybody would consider kind of a spectacular, maybe even unexpected result. And so these races are competitive and they're going to stay competitive. And remember, if Republicans can't pick up these seats right now, in 2 years, these districts are all going to be redrawn and we could have a very different environment in some of these places.
Hmm. But what do you make of the Katie Porter race, also in Orange County? But she is extremely progressive and doesn't seem to be having any problem in her reelection race.
I think it is worth noting, you make a great point, Madeline, that in the last election cycle in 2018, there were not two, but there were four Orange County congressional districts that turned from Republican to Democrat. And it is noteworthy that the Republicans are, frankly, only seriously contesting two of them this year. Mike Levin down in the southern part of the district appears to have a safe path to reelection. And Katie Porter as well, both are running against very underfunded candidates. And while you're right, Porter is very, very progressive. That's allowed her to become almost a national rock star in Democratic circles around the country. And so at this point, her fundraising advantage is so prohibitive. Couple that with the fact that Republicans were not able to recruit a candidate with fundraising capability. And both of those other two seats that turned 2 years ago do look safely Democrat at this point.
And Paul, you said earlier that more Democrats are returning their ballots by mail and early on, and Republicans are expected to vote more in person. But what does that mean in terms of votes counted? Because could it be that the Republicans actually won't turn out enough people on Election Day to win the day?
Well, I do think that there's this challenge where there are tens of thousands of Republicans in Orange County in these key districts who are holding on to their ballots, who have put them on the kitchen counter. And just because of what they're hearing in the national rhetoric around vote by mail, what they're hearing from the president, they're saying, you know, I just don't trust vote by mail. Even if they voted by mail in the past, they're saying in polling, like, I'm going to vote in person. That's almost like it's like a brand. Voting early has become more blue wave and voting late becomes a red wave kind of a thing. And the challenge is that come Election Day, we might find things that a lot of these voters have never seen before. In suburban communities, long lines at the polling places, the social distancing, meaning that there's going to be fewer actual voting machines in each polling place, meaning that you're going to be going through a process that might have taken 5 minutes just down at your local vote center, and now it might take 30 minutes or an hour or more. Those kind of barriers on election day are something that I don't think a lot of these voters are really prepared for thinking about. And it could have the effect of depressing their eventual turnout if they are insisting on using the old voting in person method and instead of just mailing in those ballots that they have.
Especially considering that the conservative voters are more likely to be older, right? And might not want to wait online for hours.
And that's why Republicans historically have been just such better vote by mail voters throughout the state. For the last few decades, as we've been increasing the vote by mail, it really has been those older voters who have taken made the most use of it. And traditionally, they were also the voters that were the quickest to return their ballots. And the fact that this year we're seeing early Democratic returns of those ballots is just an anomaly. We've just never seen something like this before. And we'll wait to see as we get closer to Election Day, those Republican voters probably coming in and voting late and in big numbers and see what impact it has on those races.
Paul Mitchell is vice president of Political Data, Inc. It's a bipartisan voter data firm. And Dan Schnur teaches at USC, UC Berkeley and Pepperdine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Okay, just a few more days till the end of our Power in Numbers drive, and we want you to count yourself in if you haven't done so already. Just have not that much longer to go before we shut it all down. So now is the time to do it. Go online at kcrw.com/join. It's a great way to show your support for KCRW, for the news that you get, the news that you need as we prepare to tackle this historic election. And we've been talking about it both on the national level and on the local level, as you just heard. So we're giving you the information you need as you make your decisions at the ballot box. KCRW.com/join. That is the place to do it. We have a great challenge grant in place right now, so your dollar goes twice as far. We will unlock $25,000 if we reach a certain amount, and so your dollar will go, will match your dollar, dollar for dollar, by midnight tonight. So do it now, kcrw.com/join. Coming up, journalist Yashar Ali on his sexual harassment allegations against Rick Jacobs, a top aide to Mayor Eric Garcetti. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 3 months ago, an LAPD officer who served on Mayor Eric Garcetti's security detail sued the city, claiming that Garcetti's longtime advisor, Rick Jacobs, repeatedly sexually harassed him and that Garcetti saw some of it firsthand but did nothing to stop it. The story resurfaced earlier this week when journalist Yashar Ali detailed his personal experience with Rick Jacobs in his newsletter. Ali says over a period of 10 years between 2005 and 2015, he was sexually harassed by Jacobs. The LA Times reports two other men have made similar claims, although they asked not to be named out of fear of retaliation. Well, now Jacobs is stepping back from his nonprofit work and his volunteer position in the mayor's office, and the city has hired an outside law firm to investigate the sexual misconduct claims. Yashar Ali joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Why did you decide to go public with this now?
Well, I decided to go public with it because I felt like the story was not getting enough attention. I was going to write a story myself. I had reporting on Rick Jacobs's misconduct, not related to me, and to, as I revealed in my story earlier this week, in term with respect to Mayor Garcetti's knowledge of that misconduct and what he did and didn't do about it. And I had to put my own story in there because it's a conflict of interest. And so I felt, you know, that I had to reveal that conflict in my story. And of course I didn't realize at the time that I would become the story as a part of this process. But you know, it was just people weren't paying attention to it. So I felt like I had to say something.
And so talk about your story. What was your experience?
I knew Rick through, I used to work in politics, and I knew Rick through political circles. I considered him a friend. And whenever I would encounter him, say probably 9 times out of 10, over the course of 10 years at political functions, social and charitable functions, sometimes at his house, he would forcibly kiss me on the lips in front of others and, you know, just sort of do what he wanted to do in that respect. And I never, ever gave an indication that I was interested in that sort of contact, but I also never said anything, to be clear.
So at the time, did you view it as sexual harassment or even sexual assault?
I viewed it as sort of generally creepy, if that, you know, if I could phrase it that way. But I didn't, you know, as I detailed in my story, one of the things that our culture does with respect to gay men is that there's a stereotype that we're more promiscuous and that we don't care what kind of attention we get as long as we get it. And of course, I internalized that a little bit and didn't object to his doing this, even though I didn't want him to do it. There was no question in my mind about that.
But you never said, don't do that. Stop it. I don't like it.
I never said it. And it wasn't until I started doing a lot of reporting about sexual misconduct, especially in, you know, after the Me Too movement was reignited in 2017, that I realized that I sort of dismissed it the same way that so many women, and I'm not comparing the two, but that so many women dismiss the experiences they go through because you're conditioned to sort of think that way.
So what did you think when Officer Garza filed his lawsuit in July? Did that just bring this all up for you again?
Yeah, I wasn't surprised. You know, the stuff that he talked about sounded so familiar to me. So you know, he mentioned that Rick Jacobs would hug him forcefully. And it's sort of a strange thing to complain about for some people. They're like, well, it's just a hug. Maybe it's annoying. But Rick had a way of hugging people where you didn't have a choice whether to engage with him or not. And I remember him hugging me so tightly once that I felt like my teeth were going to break. And there was other things that Rick said that sounded like Rick, that sounded like things that Rick said to me. So I was very happy that he was willing to step out this way. And when I saw that Rick denied the allegations aggressively, that's when I texted Rick myself.
And what did you say?
Oh, I said to him, I said, look, I don't know the situation with Officer Garza, but I know what you did to me. You used to do this to me all the time. And his response, and I included in my story, was to say, all of it's fabricated. I'm paraphrasing, all of it's fabricated. None of it's true. Without acknowledging my experience, he just offered that blanket statement. I'm assuming because he didn't want to, you know, say something in a text message that could be used against him. Mm-hmm. That only made me more angry.
You also reached out to City Hall, and what was their response?
I did. I texted a senior aide to Mayor Garcetti the day after the lawsuit was filed, and also the day after I confronted Rick via text message. And I said, you know, just to let you know, Rick used to forcibly kiss me. And this may be something that I may talk about in the future. And that aide called me, and we had an off-the-record conversation. To be clear, they never tried to dissuade me from speaking out publicly. But 3 months later, I realized, God, nothing's changed. Rick is still in a position of power. City Hall knows, the mayor's office knows that I've had this experience. And, you know, frankly, at the risk of sounding like I've got a big head, because I've done so much of this reporting, usually people, when I call about something, treat it with some credibility. So I was just stunned that they weren't willing to take any action against Rick pending an investigation.
Well, now it appears they have, since you went public this week, and Jacobs is stepping away from his duties. And Garcetti has said, I take seriously all allegations of harassment with regards to Rick Jacobs. And I wonder if you could just describe their relationship. Who is Rick Jacobs to Mayor Garcetti?
Some people have described Rick's relationship with Mayor Garcetti, and it's important to also mention the First Lady, Amy Wakeland, as Machiavellian. He is incredibly influential, and not just in matters of government, but also in politics and all of the mayor's various charitable efforts. And he wields a lot of influence with both of them. And his hand is in every single pot in Garcetti's world.
Why is that? Is he just really good at his job being a political advisor?
Well, what my reporting has shown me is that he really earned a lot of loyalty particularly from Amy Wakeland, when he was willing during the 2013 campaign to set up an independent expenditure committee, raise millions of dollars, and run very harsh ads against Wendy Gruhl, who was, of course, running against Garcetti at the time. That is what made her feel comfortable trusting him, was that he was willing to step out so aggressively for them.
So, you know, what do you think this means for Garcetti politically?
Well, I think he has harmed himself. I never want to say irreparably, because, you know, times have changed, but he has harmed himself by associating himself with Rick and refusing to step away. He had an opportunity in July to make a clean break, to say, I'm not going to stand for this. I'm not going to, you know, Rick deserves, you know, an investigation. He deserves to have a fair hearing, so to speak, but I'm going to move on. And I wish Rick the best, and that's it. But he chose not to do that. He chose to go in the opposite direction. And even as someone who's done a lot of reporting about Fox News, Fox News is more aggressive with respect to sexual misconduct than the mayor, the Democratic progressive mayor of Los Angeles is.
Yashar, thanks for coming on today.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's journalist Yashar Ali. And we did reach out to both Rick Jacobs and the mayor's office. They did not respond to our request for comment by the time we went to air. All right. We just have a few seconds now in between stories to get you to join or renew your membership or add a little bit onto your existing membership at kcrw.com/join. Lots of great reasons to join. You probably know them. How much you use this radio station, especially now during the pandemic, and how much we rely on you. I don't need to say it over and over again. You know the drill. Lots of great thank you gifts, including the ability to contribute to the LA Regional Food Bank, which in this time of crisis is absolutely necessary to help people who are actually hungry in our country. In the richest country on earth, there are people who go hungry every day. KCRW.com/join to do that, to help them and to help us out. All right, coming up, one woman's 20-year battle to get her husband released from prison.
I think it's what happens when we have overzealous prosecution that takes place. I think it's what happens when we have people that are not necessarily interested in justice.
The couple at the center of the new documentary, Time, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In many ways, the love story of Fox and Rob Rich is a familiar one. They fell in love in high school. They got married. They started a family and had big dreams of running a hip-hop clothing business in Shreveport, Louisiana. But soon, their story took a very, very dark turn. Desperate to succeed, one day in 1997, Fox Rich dropped her husband and his nephew off at a local credit union. They wanted to rob it. He was eventually sentenced to 60 years in prison. She took a plea deal and served about 3.5 years. And when Fox was released, she was left without a husband to raise their 6 sons. The Sundance documentary, Time, follows Fox and Rob's story of love and hope.
Time is when you look at pictures from when your babies were small, and then you look at them and you see that they have mustaches and beards. And that the biggest hope that you had was that before they turned into men, they would have a chance to be with their father.
Through old home movies, we watch their sons grow from babies to young men. We watch Fox Rich rebuild her life, atone for her mistakes, try to hold her family together. The documentary chronicles her 20-year fight with the court system to free her husband, Rob. He finally walked out of prison 2 years ago. And joining us from the documentary Time are Fox and Rob Rich. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
So before we get to how your lives changed, can you just talk a little bit about the before period, like before you decided to rob the bank? Just tell me about your life then. What was it like?
It was the most beautiful thing I had ever imagined for myself. My high school sweetheart had asked me to marry him after 10 years of dating on and off. And I picked up a camera because I was so proud and wanted to record the creation of this family, one that I had longed for many years. And 6 months later, we found ourselves in Louisiana's criminal justice system faced with losing our business and making a horrible mistake to try and take money to regain financial solvency. I had lost my family. And so being able to record those moments of what transpired after that, I think that, you know, before all of this took off, I just knew that we had the world in our hands and every opportunity to build a great family. And we were very happy.
And so then begins your long journey in the court system. And initially, you were both offered a plea deal. And then Robbie didn't take it on the advice of another lawyer. And you were sentenced to 60 years. Why 60 years for a first-time offense?
I think it's what happens when we have overzealous prosecution that takes place. I think it's what happens when we have people that are not necessarily interested in justice. I think it's what happens when people are led more so by race than they are, or racism, than they are led by the spirit of doing what's right. Not taking the plea bargain and then subsequently deciding to go on to trial in no way changes the facts or circumstances around the act itself. So how do we deviate away from a 10 to 18 year plea bargain, even if it was fumbled at the hand of the attorney that gave the advice for me to withdraw my guilty plea? It still does not change in any way the facts of our case.
Yeah, it seems a little arbitrary, to say the least, to change it so dramatically.
In the state of Louisiana, armed robbery carries the charger at that particular time, carried a sentence of a range of 5 to 99 years. You can get more time in Louisiana for armed robbery than you can get for manslaughter. The maximum time for manslaughter is 40 years. This is one tool that is used in our system to really use a lot of discretion.
Hmm. So, Fox, how did you handle that? I mean, here you are, a young mother. Were you pregnant at the time that he went to prison?
Not only was I pregnant, I found out I was pregnant with twins while we were both in jail. I knew that those leading the system were upset with us because of how the attorneys that we had hired had handled our matter. I knew that they were going to throw the book at us for taking the matter to trial, but I had no clue that they would take his life by death by incarceration by handing down a 60-year sentence. It was not fathomable.
Yeah. Did you give birth to your twins while you were incarcerated?
Oh, my goodness. You know, my deepest prayer first was, as I said, in the prison ward at the hospital, waiting to see the OBGYN doctor. I just, you know, really cried out, God, please don't let me have my babies like this. I know that I have broken the law. I know that whatever it is that I have to do to fix this or pay for this, I'll do, but please don't allow me to have my babies in handcuffs and shackles. That's no way for a baby to come into the world. And then I go upstairs to the OBGYN and they do the ultrasound, and it's not one baby, it's two babies. And I I break out crying. I got an armed guard at the door and an armed guard by my side in the exam room. And I break out crying and laughing at the same time because I knew, one, that twins didn't run in my family. So I thought that this wasn't even something possible for me. But for God to give me something so beautiful at the darkest moment of my life, to me, was a signal that that we would be okay.
And so did you give birth in prison or no?
No. They ended up, because I was pregnant with twins, reducing my bond from $500 million to $5,000. And my mother was gracious enough to put the money together and bond me out. Oh. So after I had delivered the babies and spent 10 months after their birth, I had to turn myself in because they did decide at that point that they wanted me to serve time.
And Rob, for you, how is it being behind bars and not being able to see your brand new babies and hold them? Like, what was that like?
Painful, to say the least. It was callous, you know, to think that that this is, you know, the beginning of what this would look like. But I can also say that when visitation did finally come around and Fox was able to bring the boys to visitation, and for me to hold them, you know, in my arms, you know, felt natural. It felt real, felt warming and all of the things that it's supposed to feel. And it felt those things despite prison walls. So for that, I was thankful, but at the same time, furious in the sense that my wife had been left alone to have to endure this, you know, by herself. And to know that our criminal justice system, those that administer it, had an opportunity on more than one occasion to fix what had been made so mistakenly wrong in our life in terms of issuing out a 60-year sentence for myself, didn't make no earthly sense whatsoever. I guess God had something different in store for us, because it's beautiful now to be able to look and see that our story, which is the story of more than 2.3 million other families, that are languishing away in our prison system across the country, to be able to see that a story like ours is finding its way to the light of day, is some kind of way of repayment. And to be able to come home and come home to my family in such grand fashion. And when I say that, just, you know, with open arms and loving hearts and those kind of things, again, like I said, just started to kind of repair some of what had been made so terribly wrong.
Mm. The governor, John Bel Edwards, commuted your sentence in June of 2018. You were released in September. And why do you think that your sentence was commuted, and why yours out of all the inmates that are in the penitentiary? Why you?
Clemency is an act of mercy. And I had managed to spend 21 years of my life at that particular time where I was basically write-up free. I had only had one rule infraction for the 21 years that I was incarcerated. To say that I managed to only cure one write-up, if you would, over a period of 21 years in America's bloodiest prison is a testament in and of itself. So when you ask the question, why me? Then it would have to be more so, why not me?
And Fox, how much of your efforts or your advocacy do you think led to his sentence being commuted?
When you talk about a family in a 21-year and four-day journey, it wasn't just I. It was every member of our family have given something to get us to this moment. Whether it was our youngest son dancing in the French quarters and during a time when business was slow, having to pitch in on his tips to help pay the electric bill, or it was other sons who were advocating and raising light to their father's name in their own environments. We have all worked to make sure that we have freedom at the forefront and restoration of our family at the forefront of our minds. So, and even Rob on the inside, having to learn law, having to walk such a steady road that he could protect himself from harm on the inside, as well as maintain his own mental capacity when you have a life sentence hanging over your head every day. So I'm just really proud of the people that I had this journey with and how our sons, you know, showed up.
Let's talk about your sons, the twins that you mentioned that you were pregnant with. they're now grown up, right? They're adults.
Yes. They will be 21 next week.
Oh, wow. And so what have they been doing? Did they go to college? What are their plans? What do they want to be?
The twins worked the family's business with me their 9th and 10th grade year in high school, and they went to homeschool. And then they took their GED test and then started college at Tulane at 16 years old. Since their first year at Tulane, Justice has joined the Army to serve our country, and he is stationed in Korea. And Freedom has gone on to get a full merit scholarship at Loyola University and is the 2021 Student Government Association president.
Oh, my goodness. And what does he want to be?
He's looking to go to law school. Freedom wants definitely further policies and create and change policies that he has experienced firsthand that he know would make it different for 2.3 million American families.
Who have a member of the family incarcerated. And your other sons, you have four more sons, right?
Yes, we have four more sons. We have Malik, who is a sommelier, is what I'm trying to get out. He is leading the way to a new bar that will be open whenever we get past COVID. And our son Remington, the second oldest, just passed his final boards. And the only thing between he and his degree in dentistry is a few patients.
Wow.
Babe, I'm going to let you talk about Lawrence. That lovable.
Lawrence is our fitness guru. He is exploring a career in fitness. In addition to, he has taken up with the favorite pastime of his mother and father, and he has found himself in love with a young lady that he is not willing to part from for no reason whatsoever.
Robert is just waiting on the film to come out. He's excited about that. And he is trying to find him a girlfriend. So, you know, I think he spends most of his days going back and forth with his father about, now, what should I text her back?
Oh, that's so cute. How old is he?
He's 14.
Wow. So all the boys are doing well.
Yes.
Which is really a testament to you both, because most or a lot of kids who have a father incarcerated, they don't do as well statistically.
Mm-hmm. A lot of kids who have a father in their home aren't doing well these days in America. Mm-hmm. I think our son Remington said it best, that he just realized with some of his peers that he had a closer relationship with his incarcerated father than many of his friends whose father were in their home had with them.
Well, congratulations on the movie and congratulations on your freedom, Rob, and all the best for you as you begin this new chapter in your lives.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been quite a pleasure.
Fox and Rob Rich, and their story is told in the documentary Time. It's streaming on Amazon Prime beginning October 23rd. Right. Just a few more days until we end our fall membership drive. Time for you, speaking of time, to get in on the action at kcrw.com/join. Join Susan Kokari from Santa Monica, Julie Dubrow from Marina Del Rey, Frederick Zimmerman from Santa Monica, Malia Shank from Santa Ana, Sylvia Lee from LA, Nick Hunt from Seattle, Washington. And the list goes on and on. These are just a few people who joined just in the last hour. So now is the time for you to do that as well. KCRW.com/join. And joining me now, Steve Teotegas. Hi.
Hello. So coming up on the show, Madeline, we're going to talk about COVID, the coronavirus, more numbers that we're watching, and we're seeing a rise in coronavirus cases and deaths across the country. Not so much here in California, but a lot of folks are keeping an eye, especially Barbara Ferrer, the director of the Department of Public Health here in LA County. We're going to talk to her coming up on the show.
Oh, fantastic. So do not miss that. So there you go. Just another reason to donate to KCRW. We bring you these timely, important interviews that you need to make sense of your world. KCRW.com/join. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here with recommendations for Halloween treats, so don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, Halloween is right around the corner, and even though we may not be trick-or-treating like we would in pre-times, it is still a good time to treat ourselves to something delicious. Evan Kleinman is here to share a few Halloween treat ideas, host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi, Evan.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, no one's really going to buy a bunch of disgusting bulk candy, right?
I have to say
that's a good thing.
I have to say that this year, if that's what you're resorting to, shame on you. Yeah. At least get your inner circle full-size candy bars. I mean, since the quantity that we're going to be handing out is so much less, we can actually have delicious things. And also, unlike, you know, regular years where like a stranger might not want to take your homemade goodies and feed them to their child. Yeah. Since really you're not going to be handing anything to strangers this year, we can go back to having maybe one or two handmade treats.
And you are here to tell us which ones we should hand out to ourselves and our friends.
Absolutely. But before we get to the recipe for pumpkin whoopie pies, let's talk about what people can get around town and bring home. They're homemade. Okay. They're just not made in our homes.
Okay, so go for it.
Okay, so for the sophisticate, so maybe for adults,
Sophisticate.
Yes.
The sophisticate gorger of candied treats, yes?
Yes, Valerie Confections. The very first time I ever interviewed Valerie Gordon for Good Food was when she burst onto the confectionery scene with her molded chocolate skull. Now, she's not making those anymore because they're wildly too expensive to make, but her confectionery and cake business is extraordinary. And for Halloween, she has a few things going on. She's making pumpkin petit fours. Her petit fours are just incredible. I recently ordered two boxes for people who were getting married. She has a black cat box of truffles and a bat bar of chocolate topped with black lava salt. And she makes unbelievable toffee. So for Halloween, she's made some black sesame toffee.
Oh, that sounds so good.
So good.
And you can just order that online, right?
You can absolutely order it. Yes, you can order it online and you can pick up at, you can arrange for delivery or pick it up at one of the two locations, either on First Street near Beverly or in Echo Park. And then for the family, Little Flower Candy Company is finally open again, which we're so thrilled about in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And amongst the goodies they're making are these adorable chocolate coffin cakes. Mm. They're so adorably decorated, and they're bigger than a cupcake, but not quite as big as a full-size cake. So they're perfect for the family who's at home and wants to do something a little different but delicious.
Smaller than a coffin, I assume.
My brain just went to people pulled up against a chocolate coffin eating.
Yum.
What a great funeral that would be.
Yeah,
I think I need to change my end of life plans now.
Okay, so that's for the sophisticate. I guess,
no,
right?
For the sophisticate, we have Valerie, and for the family, we have Little Flower. Okay. And then I also have some parent and child activities that are going on. Gourmandise Cooking School is offering a daytime baking class on October 31st, where the parent and child duo can make their own Devil's Food Dirt Cupcakes and homemade pumpkin spice Oreos.
Ah, That sounds so good.
Sounds so good. And then Delilah Snell down at Alta Baja Market at the 4th Street Market in Santa Ana is doing a sugar skull and sugar cookie decorating workshop on October 31st at 4 p.m. in honor of Day of the Dead.
So this actually sounds like a more delectable, at least to me, version of Halloween than the normal Halloween.
Yes, and I should say that every single bakery that you frequent this year is doing a beautiful job with cookies. Oh, yes, I left out. Clementine in West Los Angeles every year does wonderful things. This year they're doing adorably decorated spooky cupcakes.
Your dog seems to agree.
Yeah, Paco is really wants to taste those. And platters of decorated sugar cookies. Their stuff is always top quality and beautifully done.
Okay, let's talk about your recipe for a pumpkin whoopie pie.
Okay, so my friend Clemence of Gourmandy shared this recipe with me. Now, a whoopie pie is such a weird thing because it's like a sandwich cookie, but the cookie parts are cake. So that's what a whoopie pie really is. It's a cake batter that you scoop onto a sheet pan and it sort of spreads out into this perfect size. So you're making basically a pumpkin cake, and then inside the two pieces of whoopie cake will be a buttercream, and it's a really delicious butter and cream cheese icing with a zested orange. So you're eating the tender pumpkin cake with the spices, and then you have this fluffy orange flavored cream.
Okay, where can listeners get this recipe?
We can find the pumpkin whoopie pies on the Gourmandy's website, and we will have a link to it on our website.
Okay, our website, again, kcrw.com. By the way, that's where you can go and become a member at kcrw.com. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I love that song. All right. This is the end of the show, but it is not the end of my pitch to you to go online at kcrw.com/join. We just have a few more days left of our fundraiser, so it's just going by with lightning speed, just like our election season. So if you appreciate all the news that we give you during this election season, and it has been a crazy one, we try to keep you sane and try to parse the craziness from the facts and just give you the facts and informed opinion, then you need to support it because, well, it doesn't come free and it's pretty expensive to run a radio station, especially during a pandemic. So we need you to be in it with us at kcrw.com/join. So many people have decided to do that, and really heartfelt thanks to everyone who have signed up so far and contributed to KCRW, either by becoming a new member or renewing their membership, donating a little extra. Some people donate for people who can't, because there are plenty of people who are on hard financial times these days, and we totally understand that. If you have not experienced such large financial hardship as many of our neighbors, then won't you please consider donating for them at kcrw.com/join. Sylvia Lee of Los Angeles, she says, love the daily and press play. She's a new member. Welcome aboard. Nick Hunt from Seattle, he is a lapsed member and he is back. Welcome back into the fold. Andrew Wissmiller from Santa Monica, a brand new member. Thomas Pacchioretti, I hope I pronounced your name right, also from Santa Monica, another lapsed member. So no judgment if you're a lapsed member. Come back in. The water's warm. Lots of great thank you gifts at kcrw.com/join. That'll do it for me today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brandon. I'll see you tomorrow.